Tonight we're going to take, at least begin at 2 Kings chapter 15, verse 32. And Lord willing, go through chapter 17, if we can. I say Lord willing. Who knows what we're going to run into. But if you remember, at 2 Kings chapter 15, beginning at verse 8, from 2 Kings 15, 8, through now to the end of chapter 17, we are on a journey of a downward spiral of the last 43 years before the captivity of Israel. That is, before the Assyrians take the northern kingdom captive. We have a study of six northern kings, two southern kings, and the captivity from chapter 15, verse 8, through to the end of chapter 17. And the one who is chronicling these accounts for us is writing with one motive and one motive only. Up to now, all the way from 1 Kings chapter 1, verse 1, all the way up to where we're at in 2 Kings here in chapter 15, everything has been presented to us in order to show how God's judgment and God's wrath comes upon unrepentant sin. That's the whole purpose of it. There are some kings who are very good, and none of their good deeds are ever mentioned, because he's not just writing down a historical account. He's writing down how God deals with sin. That's what he's doing. And beginning at 2 Kings chapter 15, verse 8, we have a series of kings in the north that were actually assassinating. One was assassinating the other. A military commander would assassinate a king, and he would become king. And whoever assassinated the king would become king. They weren't appointed king. God did not appoint them. They were murdering in order to become king. And so, but then we had in the south, we had Azariah or Uzziah, who reigned in the south. And we're going to see Jotham tonight. And Ahaz, his son, as they began to rule in the south. So we've seen a series of kings. Leading off with Pekah. And Pekah was the king of Israel in the north. And in verse 32, we're going to pick up now in the south in Judah. As we're going to pick up for the Uzziah, the king, or Azariah, as he's also called. There's two different spellings for the same person. But in verse 32 it says, in the second year of Pekah, the son of Remaliah. So he's in each one of these instances, stages, he's backing up and placing the king now in the south at a certain point in history in Pekah's reign. But in verse 31, he has already died. But now he's backing up and showing that in the second year of Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, that Jotham, the word Jotham means Yahweh is perfect or complete. That Jotham, the son of Uzziah, king of Judah, began to reign. He was 25 years old when he became king. Now you remember, he served for about 10 years because his father was ill before he died. So he was serving in his place for about 10 years. And when Uzziah or Azariah died, Jotham took over, and he was 25 years old when he became king. And he reigned for 16 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Jerusha, the daughter of Zadok. Zadok, if you remember, was the high priest in Israel. So she was from a high priestly family. So Jotham's mother was Jerusha, who is the daughter of Zadok. And he did what was right in the sight of the Lord. He did according to all that his father Uzziah had done. So he picks up right where Uzziah left off. You remember Uzziah, or Azariah as he's also known, did what was right in the sight of the Lord, except he left the high places for worship. We will see too in verse 35, however, the high places were not removed. The high places where the Canaanites used to worship, up on the high places, But the children of Israel would worship Yahweh. They didn't worship the pagan gods there. They worshiped Yahweh there. And it is interesting, as we have studied in all these chapters, is that the kings apparently didn't feel like there was anything wrong. I mean, if they're worshiping Yahweh, who cares where they're doing that, even if it's at the pagan deities? We're going to see tonight that it matters to God. And that those of his peoples, he's making responsible for not only worshiping him, but worshiping him in the prescribed way. We will also see tonight that there's no such thing as accepting one another's religions. There's a prescribed way in which God wants to be worshipped. And we don't worship him on our terms, we worship him on his terms. So even worshiping in the wrong place, because the king could see nothing wrong with it. But God had designated places for worship. But they left the high places, which were places for pagan worship. And the people still sacrificed and burned incense on the high places. He built the upper gate of the house of the Lord. Now, he was known, in fact, 2 Chronicles in chapter 27 tells us that not only did he build the upper gate, which literally means to rebuild it because it was already built, the upper gate was the gate in which the royal family came through to go in the city and into the temple. And so he repaired that. He built many cities in the mountains and in the forests, and he was known for great building projects, and he helped physically build up Jerusalem and the surrounding areas, and so that was credited to his account as to what he accomplished as he was king. Verse 38. Now the rest of the acts of Jotham and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah? In those days the Lord began to send Rezin, king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, against Judah. Now Pekah, remember, was the king in the north. In his second year of reign, that is when Jotham took over. The text says, the Lord began to send Rezin, king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, against Judah. Part of God's judgment was to send these armies, northern Israel, as well as the Syrian king, against Judah. And they will eventually conquer them. It'll take them quite some time. But God's going to send them against Judah. So Jotham rested with his fathers and was buried with his fathers in the city of David, his father. Then Ahaz, his son, reigned in his place. Now here's where bad turns to worse. You remember Jotham kept everything intact the way his father did it. Ahaz was just the opposite. Wait till we get to Ahaz. In the 17th year of Pekah, so approximately 15 years later, Jotham reigned 16, the son of Remaliah, Ahaz, the son of Jotham, king of Judah, began to reign. Ahaz was 20 years old when he became king, and he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem. And he did not do what was right in the sight of the Lord his God, as his father David had done. But he walked in the way of the kings of Israel. Indeed, he made his son pass through the fire, according to the abominations of the nations whom the Lord had cast out before the children of Israel. So the first thing he did was he worshipped Moloch, M-O-L-E-C-H, which was a Canaanite god, and the only way to worship Moloch was to place your children in the fire as sacrifice. Here is a king in Judah, and the nation in the southern part had decayed so much and corrupted so much that he was now participating in Moloch worship, and he was actually sacrificing his children in the fire. Next. Then Rezin, king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, came up to Jerusalem to make war. And they besieged Ahaz, but they could not overcome him. So he had strong resistance here. He also, it is told to us, that we'll see in a moment, that he looks to Assyria for help. And he's going to get in trouble for that. So God is sending them. Now remember with verse 5, we must connect verse 5 with chapter 15, verse 37. The Lord is the one who sent them. The Lord said, sent the king of Syria and the king in the north, that is Israel, against him. This is part of God's judgment. Next, verse 7. So Ahaz sent messengers to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, saying, I am your servant and your son. Come up and save me from the hand of the king of Syria and from the hand of the king of Israel, who rise up against me. And Ahaz took the silver and gold that was found in the house of the Lord and in the treasures of the king's house, and sent it as a present to the king of Assyria. The word present in Hebrew is the word for bribe. So the king of Assyria heeded him, for the king of Assyria went up against Damascus and took it, carried its people captive to Kir, and killed Rezin. So it's interesting that, in fact, in Isaiah, I believe it is, Isaiah chapter 7, verses 1 through 7, it says there that he is warned by the prophet to not go to Assyria, that he should not go down and seek help. But he did it anyway. He went down to seek Assyria for help in order to fight against Syria and northern Israel. And Assyria came to his aid. But see, here's the bad part about it is that when they came to his aid and he gave them a bribe, they took all the treasuries out of the temple and out of the royal house and gave it to the king of Assyria. But then Judah became a vassal slave to Assyria. I mean, they sold out. He would not trust the Lord. He would not turn to the Lord. And the reason he couldn't is because the Lord sent the enemy. He says in verse 10, Now King Ahaz went to Damascus to meet Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria. And he saw an altar that was at Damascus. And King Ahaz sent to Urijah, the priest, to design the design of the altar and its pattern according to all of its workmanship. Now this is all to tell us why God's judgment is coming. He goes to Damascus and he sees an altar that is used in pagan worship, and he says, you know, I like that altar. I want that altar in the temple instead of the one that God designed and commanded to be done. So he sent the design and pattern to Urijah for him to build, and Urijah builds it so that when Ahaz comes back from Damascus, here is a new altar in the temple. So he's taken all the treasuries out of the temple. He's going to build a new altar like a pagan altar that he liked instead of the one that God commanded to design. He's also at one point going to close up the temple and forbid the people to worship in it anymore. I mean, that's how corrupt, spiritually corrupt the nation had come. And so verse 11 says, Then Urijah the priest built an altar according to all that King Ahaz had sent from Damascus. So Urijah the priest made it before King Ahaz came back from Damascus. And when the king came back from Damascus, the king saw the altar, and the king approached the altar and made offerings on it. Another sin upon sin. The king offered and not the priest. He is now taking over the priestly work. He is offering his own sacrifices on the altar. So he burnt his burnt offering and his grain offering, and he poured his drink offering and sprinkled the blood of his peace offerings on the altar. He also brought the bronze altar which was before the Lord from the front of the temple, from between the altar and the house of the Lord, and put it in the north side of this new altar. So he took the bronze altar that God commanded, he removed it, and he put it over on the north side so that his new altar can be placed in its place. Then King Ahaz commanded Urijah the priest, saying, On the great altar burn the morning burnt offerings, the evening grain offerings, the king's burnt sacrifice, and his grain offering, with the burnt offering of all the people of the land, their grain offerings and their drink offerings, and sprinkle on it all the blood of the burnt offering and all the blood of the sacrifice. So basically, he just replaced the bronze altar which God commanded to make with this pagan altar. But now notice this last phrase. And the bronze altar shall be for me to inquire by. In other words, the altar that he had built was now going to be for the sacrifices of both of himself and all of the people. The altar that God had made for the sacrifices was now put over to the side, and he says, this altar is going to be something special. He says, and the bronze altar shall be for me to inquire by. In the Hebrew, it gets a little complicated, but here's basically what the Hebrew says. That on the bronze altar, I can take the liver of the animals and seek guidance by divination. He was seeking signs by dissecting the organs of animals. It was witchcraft. He was like tea leaves, only he was doing it with the organs of animals on the altar that God had set up for sacrifice. Thus did Elijah the priest, according to all that King Ahaz commanded. And King Ahaz cut off the panels of the carts and removed the lavers from them, and he took down the sea from the bronze oxen that were under it and put on it a pavement of stones. Also he removed the Sabbath pavilion which they built in the temple. That would be the overhang for the priests to walk through. And he removed the king's outer entrance from the house of the Lord on account of the king of Assyria. In other words, when the king of Assyria was to come, he didn't want him to see it. He took down anything. It was interesting that when he was afraid the king of Assyria would come in and see all the things that Yahweh had commanded, he wanted the appearance to be that the same as in Damascus, so that if the king of Assyria should ever come, he would see an altar that's exactly like in Damascus. And he would say, he would have the entire temple, the appearance of the temple changed so it would look more like an Assyrian temple rather than a temple from God. Now the rest of the acts of Ahaz which he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah? So Ahaz rested with his fathers and was buried with his fathers in the city of David. Then Hezekiah, his son, reigned in his place. In the 12th year of Ahaz, king of Judah, Hoshea, the son of Elah, became king of Israel. So now we're back up in the north when Ahaz was still king of Judah. In the 12th year, Hoshea, the son of Elah, became king of Israel in Samaria, and he reigned for 9 years. Hoshea means Yahweh saves. Hoshea comes from the root words where Hosea comes from. It's also where Joshua comes from. It's also where Jesus comes from. It means Yahweh is salvation. Hoshea. And he did evil in the sight of the Lord, but not as the kings of Israel who were before him. Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, came up against him. Shalmaneser would be the son of Tiglath-Pileser. Tiglath-Pileser has since died, and Shalmaneser is now king of Assyria, and he came up against Hoshea in the north. Remember, Ahaz was in the south. All that corruption went on in Jerusalem and in the temple area. Meanwhile, while Ahaz was performing all of this corruption in the north, we have now have Hoshea as king, and he is now fighting with Shalmaneser, who is king of Assyria. And Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, came up against him, and Hoshea became his vassal and paid him tribute money. So basically he says, I quit. I do not want to fight you. And what is interesting is that these various nations have been coming around helping out. And God has allowed Israel to become weaker and weaker militarily, to where Hoshea just says, we give up. And they became a vassal state. A vassal state just means the king is not removed. Nobody is removed. But they now have to pay tribute to the leading nation. They're saying, we're going to leave you here, and you guys stay in your own homes, and you can keep your king, but he answers to us. Slaves, in other words. But it's too much trouble to remove them, and what are you going to do when you remove them? Then you've got to replace them with people and work it yourself. So they said, you guys work it. You guys be our slaves. And every year they paid him tribute money. And the king of Assyria, verse 4, uncovered a conspiracy by Hoshea, for he had sent messengers to Seoul. Seoul is the name of a city. It says Seoul, he's a king, it is also the name of the city, king of Egypt, and brought no tribute to the king of Assyria, as he had done year by year. Therefore the king of Assyria shut him up and bound him in prison, that is, put him in chains. Now the king of Assyria went throughout all the land and went up to Samaria and besieged it for 3 years. Verses 5 and 6 really is the summary of everything in 1 and 2 Kings that we've studied so far. It took him 3 years to besiege Samaria in the north. In the 9th year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria took Samaria and carried Israel away to Assyria and placed them in, and these are all the cities, and most of them we don't know much about, in Hala and by the Habor and the river Gozan and in the cities of the Medes. So in 722 BC, Assyria finally broke through and conquered Samaria. And it's interesting that now it's called Samaria in the text when it's been called Israel all this time. But that's how closed in they became. As I shared with you last week in chapter 15, verse 31, that by the time we got to that part of the nation Israel in the north, was only 40 miles long and 30 miles wide. That's all that was left. God had allowed the enemies to come in and take the land little by little. And now the Israelites were totally surrounded to the point that it was called Samaria now. And they took away the captives. It is interesting that Shalmaneser, he ruled from 725 BC to 722 BC. He actually died and didn't see the total takeover. His son Sargon finished the job and took Israel captive. And it says in the annals of Sargon that he captured 50 chariots and took over 29,000 people as slaves, away captive. So if you want a total, that's the only way we know, is from the records of Assyria. They have records there that like a diary that shows how many were taken. Now, from verse 7 on, tells us now the details. This is now the commentary of 1 and 2 Kings, as far as the northern kingdom of Israel is concerned. For so it was that the children of Israel had sinned against the Lord their God, who brought them up out of Egypt from under the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and they had feared other gods. So the sin began when he first delivered them from out of Egypt. God brought them up out of Egypt, but as soon as they began to travel in the wilderness is when they began to fear other gods. And had walked in the statutes of the nations whom the Lord had cast out from before the children of Israel and of the kings of Israel, which they had made. Also the children of Israel secretly did against the Lord, their God, things that were not right. And they built for themselves high places in all their cities, from watchtower to fortified city, which is just a Hebrew phrase that means all over the place, from one end to the other. They set up for themselves sacred pillars and wooden images on every high hill and under every green tree, which means everywhere. There they burned incense on all the high places, like the nations whom the Lord had carried away before them. And they did wicked things to provoke the Lord to anger. In other words, There is only one prescribed way of worship. The children of Israel, they worshiped Yahweh. They had the writings, they had the scriptures. But they just incorporated a style of worship that was like the Canaanites whom they conquered. And God says, no, I will not be worshipped that way. And they compromised. They said, oh, well, they believe in God. We can, they got some good things in their worship service. We can incorporate them into ours, you know. God said, no. And they provoked him to anger. And they served idols, of which the Lord had said to them, you shall not do this thing, found in Exodus chapter 20, verses 3 to 5. They were not to worship idols or statues. And that's still true today. Yet the Lord testified against Israel and against Judah by all of his prophets, every seer, saying, turn from your evil ways and keep my commandments and my statutes according to all the law which I commanded your fathers and which I sent to you by my servants, the prophets. They even rejected every prophet that God sent. Nevertheless, they would not hear, but stiffened their necks, like the necks of their fathers who did not believe in the Lord their God. In the Bible, God's people are called stiff-necked people. I don't know if you're like me. Sometimes you wake up, you know, and you slept wrong, and you have a stiff neck. Well, it doesn't mean that they walked around with stiff necks. To have a stiff neck meant that, for instance, if somebody came up and said, bow down to me, and they grabbed you by the back of the head to pull you down so that you would bow down to them, and you stiffened your neck because you're not going to submit, that's what he's talking about. They stiffened their necks. It's an example, a metaphor, to show the condition of their hearts. We refuse to submit and do things God's will. They were stiff-necked. They refused to bow. And they rejected his statutes and his covenant that he had made with their fathers and his testimonies, which he had testified against them. They followed idols, became idolaters, and went after the nations who were all around them, concerning whom the Lord had charged them that they should not do like them. Don't do like everybody else does. Do according to my word. But they worshiped God according to how everybody else did. So they left all the commandments of the Lord their God, made for themselves a molded image and two calves, made a wooden image, and worshipped all the host of heaven, which means the sun and the moon and the stars, and served Baal, that's the Canaanite god. And they caused their sons and daughters to pass through the fire. So not only did Ahaz do that, but many of them took up Moloch worship and sacrificed their sons and daughters in the fire. They practiced witchcraft and soothsaying and sold themselves to do evil in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger. So what the writer of Kings is showing us is that when God brings judgment against them, the reason is because they have provoked him to anger. They have just totally rejected everything that he's had to say. They've just pushed his word out of the way. They've just done things their way. And they have not bowed and submitted to do things God's way. Now, look at how many years this is. But God just waited and waited. And they rejected more and more until it has come to this type of a corrupt thing that we've been reading in the text. Wherefore, verse 18, the Lord was very angry with Israel and removed them from his sight. There was none left but the tribe of Judah alone. God allowed Assyria to come in and take the 10 northern tribes captive, period. He removed them from his sight, even to this day. Maybe you've heard the phrase, the lost 10 tribes of Israel. It is because the Lord has removed them from his sight. They have been taken captive. Only the Lord knows where they are, because to this day, those 10 tribes are lost. When the Lord comes and he calls, according to Revelation chapter 7, that there will be 144,000 Jews upon the earth during the tribulation as witness, 12,000 from each of the 12 tribes. That's after God calls the Jews to Jerusalem. He's going to gather them, these together, 12,000 from each of the 12 tribes. God knows where the other 10 tribes are. And so Judah in the south is the only one left as far as a tribe is concerned. Verse 19. Also, Judah did not keep the commandments of the Lord their God, but walked in the statutes of Israel, which they made. Now, verse 19 is kind of like an insert here, because what he's saying is, 160 years later, after this happens, the south is going to fall too. In 586 B.C., Nebuchadnezzar is going to come into the south and take the southern part captive and lead them away. Verse 20. And the Lord rejected all the descendants of Israel, afflicted them, and delivered them into the hand of plunderers until he had cast them from his sight. For he tore Israel from the house of David. And they made Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, king. Then Jeroboam drove Israel from following the Lord and made them commit a great sin. You remember that they were supposed to go to Jerusalem to worship? He set up altars and said, "Don't go, it's too far to go. Why don't you just stay home and worship?" And he called, he caused Israel to commit sin against God. Verse 23. Until the Lord removed Israel out of his sight, and he had said by all of his servants the prophets, so Israel is carried away from their own land to Assyria, as it is to this day. Interesting, they're still there, these lost tribes. Then the king of Assyria brought people from Babylon, Cuthah, which is the city of Kutu, Ava, Hamath, and from Sepharvaim, and placed them in the cities of Samaria instead of the children of Israel, and they took possession of Samaria and dwelled in its cities. Now, just for your knowledge's sake, you remember in the New Testament, the Jews had no dealings with the Samaritans? They wouldn't even touch the ground that they walked on. Now, here's the reason why. Even though Sargon took over 27,000 captives, he still left people in the land. The rest of the people were left in the land that was called Israel, that is now called Samaria. They imported people into the land to take the place of the people they took out. The imported people mixed with the remaining Jewish people. They intermarried, intersocialized, and had families, and they became what is called a mixed breed. They were half Assyrian, half Jewish. And that's why the Jews would have no dealings with the Samaritans, is because they were only half Jewish. They were contaminated Jews, you see. And that's why the Jewish people called the Samaritans dogs. That's why when they traveled, they would go out around the entire land of Samaria to get to the other side. They wouldn't even touch their dirt. And so this is the story of how the Samaritan people, it's called Samaria because the man, Shamar, sold this land. And so the people were called the Samaritans after the man who used to own the land. But the Samaritans are a mix of Assyrians and Jewish people that are now, as the Jews would consider them, even to this day. And they're a dying breed. I forget how many. I think in 1985, there was something like 200 of them still left. And they were intermarrying in order to keep the Samaritan people alive. And there was a mental illness and deformity, because brothers and sisters were marrying in order to have children to keep the Samaritan people alive. They had a high priest, and there was a temple in Samaria, and it was locked up. And this insane man who has mental illness, he would unlock it only for certain people, and he has the scrolls of the Pentateuch. They only go by the Pentateuch. They don't go by the rest of the scriptures. And the worship is just almost like a worship service in a mental hospital. It's a real terrible tragedy, but these people are now dying off, the original descendants of the Samaritans. Verse 25, and so it was so at the beginning of their dwelling there that they did not fear the Lord. Therefore the Lord sent lions amongst them, which killed some of them. Interesting, part of God's judgment was to send lions. After the resettlement in the area, now the Samaritans, Assyrian Jewish people who have now mixed and they are now called Samaritans, God allowed lions to multiply and come in and begin to attack the people. It's because they did not fear the Lord. Now, lions were probably attracted to all the dead bodies. Remember, there's a great war. And they were attracted to the bodies that were not buried. And the lions began to multiply while they were there, and all of a sudden the people and the lions are now living together. And the text says that the lions began to attack. They didn't fear the Lord. So the Lord sent the lions, which killed some of them. So they spoke to the king of Assyria, saying, the nations whom you have removed and placed in the cities of Samaria do not know the rituals of the God of the land. Therefore he has sent lions amongst them, and indeed they are killing them because they do not know the rituals of the God of the land. So right away they're saying, we've got to come up with some kind of a ceremony. They think that there's a ritual, that the lions will go to, that God's mad because you're not doing the proper ritual. This is one of the elements of pagan worship, is that it's ceremony. That if you go through the ceremony, you are appeasing God and nothing bad will happen to you. Do you realize that religion is made out of fear? That if you really question most people who believe in God in a religious way but don't have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ, they will tell you, in essence, that I go and participate in the ceremony, but it's out of fear because they fear what God's going to do to them if they don't. And they want to do things, the ritual, the prescribed way, or else God is going to have bad things happen to them. And so they said, we don't know the rituals of the God of the land. Then the king of Assyria commanded, saying, send there one of the priests whom you brought from there. Let him go and dwell there, and let him teach them the rituals of the God of the land. Then one of the priests, whom they had carried away from Samaria, came and dwelt in Bethel, and taught them how they should fear the Lord. Verse 29, however, every nation continued to make gods of its own and put them in the shrines in the high places which the Samaritans had made. Every nation in the cities where they dwelt. The men of Babylon made Sukkoth-Benoth. Sukkoth-Benoth was a god. And we might laugh at it. I mean, whenever I read this text, I crack up. But this just goes to show you how far we can go in our worship. Sukkoth-Benoth was a statue of a chicken with its chicks. That's what they worshipped. Sukkoth is the word for chicken, and Benoth is the word for chicks. And they worshipped the mother hen and the chicks. The men of Cuth made Nergal, which was supposedly a god of war, equivalent to the Assyrian god of Mars. The men of Hamath made Ashima. Ashima was a hairless he-goat, an image of a hairless he-goat. And the Avites made Nibhaz and Tartak. Nibhaz was a image of a dog, and Tartak was the image of a donkey. And the Sephavites burned their children in the fire of Adramelech and Anamelech. Those were a horse and donkey combination, said to be brothers and sisters. And they worshipped them And they burned their children in the fire in worship to these idols. These were the gods of Sephrathaim. So they feared the Lord, and from every class they appointed for themselves priests of high places who sacrificed for them in the shrines of the high places. They feared the Lord, yet served their own gods. That's what religion does. We fear the Lord, but we incorporate every form of worship we can find so that we find the right ritual and the right thing to please Him, because we fear Him. It's all out of fear. According to the rituals of the nations from amongst whom they were carried away. To this day, they continue practicing the former rituals. They do not fear the Lord, nor do they follow their statutes, or their ordinances, or the law and commandment which the Lord had commanded the children of Jacob, whom He named Israel, with whom the Lord had made a covenant and charged them, saying, "You shall not fear other gods, nor bow down to them, nor serve them, nor sacrifice to them." That's in Exodus chapter 20, verse 5. Again, quote, "But the Lord who brought you up from the land of Egypt with great power and an outstretched arm, Him you shall fear, Him you shall worship, and to Him you shall offer sacrifice." Again, from Exodus chapter 6, 9, and Deuteronomy chapter 10. Again, a quote from Deuteronomy 5:32, "And the statutes, the ordinances, the law, and the commandment which He wrote for you, you shall be careful to observe forever. You shall not fear other gods. And the covenant that I have made with you, you shall not forget, nor shall you fear other gods. But the Lord your God you shall fear, and He will deliver you from the hand of all your enemies." Commentary: however, they did not obey, but they followed their former rituals. So these nations feared the Lord, yet served their carved images. Also their children and their children's children have continued doing as their fathers did, even to this day. This is the commentary that leads up to the captivity of the northern kingdoms. When we begin next time at chapter 18, verse 1, we begin the study of the capture of the southern kingdom. All of this was to show us what we're like, what our human nature is like, what our sin nature is like, and how God is just in His judgments, and how corrupt we can be, even compromising, but just by saying we believe in God or we fear God. Well, if we do, we'll do things His way. That is what it means to fear the Lord. Because even though God is a God of love, in the book of Hebrews, it also says He is a consuming fire. And for those Hebrews who wanted to go back into old Judaism and not follow Jesus Christ as Messiah, the writer of Hebrews says, if you're going to go back into the old ways, under the old law which condemns us, just remember, our God is a consuming fire. He is a God of judgment. He baptizes with the Holy Spirit, but He also baptizes with fire. And you must respect Him. You must fear Him. Because you shall reap what you sow. We've studied that. That's basically a title text for the book of 1 and 2 Kings. Galatians chapter 6, verses 6 and 7, where Paul says, "Be not deceived. God is not mocked, for whatsoever man sows, that he shall also reap. And so if you sow to the flesh, you shall have the flesh reap corruption. If you sow to the Spirit, you shall have the Spirit reap life everlasting." And so He is now showing us why God brought judgment and how God brought judgment and the corrupt ways. It is incorporating the worship and the rituals and the religious ways of the nations all around, and not worshiping as God prescribes. How does God prescribe us? John chapter 4. We're going to take it in a couple of weeks on Sunday morning. In John chapter 4, Jesus said to the woman at the well, who is, by the way, a Samaritan, but he said to the woman at the well, you have a place where you worship? You have a place in Jerusalem where you worship. There will come a day, and now is, when the true worshipers shall worship the Father in spirit and in truth, because God is a spirit. For the Father is seeking such to worship Him. So it's in submission to and following the Spirit of God according to God's truth. There's no other way to worship Him. To submit to and follow God's Spirit and His truth. That is the highest form of worship. We cannot compromise with what He says and say, well, I can incorporate a different form or a religious form or ceremony that is even against God's word because it is dedicated to Him, so it must be pleasing to Him. No, that is not true. There's only one way to worship. It is spiritual. It is in submission to His Spirit. And it is in submission to His truth, doing things His way. It's the highest form of worship. It isn't religious. It's relationship. It's responding to the Spirit of God and to the truth of God. That's showing Him respect. That's the highest form of worship that He receives. What is it in 2 Samuel? God says obedience is better than sacrifice. God says, I don't want your rituals and all your sacrificial animals. I want obedience. It's the only thing I look for. Obedience is better than sacrifice. It shows the one to whom you're obedient to that you worship Him as God, that you acknowledge Him as God. Our sins shall find us out. And we're reaping that as a nation and as a people as we don't take Him that serious. We don't fear Him, but He will judge. But yes, He will. Let's close with prayer.